brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at Inform IT.
Hi, I'm Kevin Davis. Thanks for tuning in to our On SOA podcast. Today, we're talking with Chris Riley. Chris is a senior consultant with SOA Systems and contributor to the recently released book, SOA Design Patterns, the most recent work in the service-oriented computing series from Thomas Earle. Now, today's discussion is the first part in a two-part discussion about versioning. It's tricky in any software architecture, but almost more so in service-oriented architecture. Chris, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
So I'll just start out with a bit of a level set. When we're speaking of versioning in service-oriented architecture, what are the types of things we're talking about? What has to be versioned in an SOA?
Mm-hmm. So within service-oriented architecture, depending upon how you've implemented it, and most people today are implementing using web service standards and XML standards, we're looking at a few different things. So if we're talking about web services specifically, we would be talking about WSDL, we'd be talking about XML schema, and more recently, we'd be also talking about WS policy. And with WSDL, of course, we're talking about what is the service providing, its capabilities. With XML schema, it extends the WSDL contract to talk about the data. And with WS policy, it is, again, articulating the policy that is going to be applied for this particular service. So the kind of core within a service-oriented architecture is always the service contract. That's how we're interacting with and consuming it as a consumer and taking advantage of capabilities. So the WSDL, if using web services for SOA, kind of then acts as the core. And there's a breakout within WSDL referred to as the abstract and the concrete portion. And typically we're speaking about the abstract portion as the area of focus when doing versioning. From there, we flow into our data, which again would be the XML schema.
Let me interrupt you there. Abstract and concrete portions of the WSDL. Can you describe those for our listeners?
Sure, absolutely. So within WSDL, it's kind of broken into the messaging, the capabilities, the operations is another way of describing it that you'd like to take advantage of. What is the service providing to a consumer? The concrete portion focuses more on how it actually does it, what type of protocol is being used, where is it on the network. So when we're dealing with contracts in the service-oriented architecture, so we're typically looking at the abstract as being the focus as an architect and a developer and creating that first and developing the interaction and the capabilities. And thus, it becomes very important when we're versioning to then focus on that section first as being kind of the core. Everything else flows from that. So our schema and our policy is associated and related to that same portion of the WSDL. Example would be if I'm interested in invoking a particular operation to add two numbers, I have to have data that I have to pass in to do that operation. My schema is then going to flow from that abstract section into a definition of two numbers or some elements that describe those two numbers. Likewise, policy will be the same thing. We're describing how we're governing the service, and that flows from the abstract section as well.
So from the abstract section, it's really like the interface, the operations, what you think of as your interface contract.
Correct.
And then the concrete is more of a how you get there and where is it?
Exactly. It's the physical manifestation of that service on the network.
Okay.
So within kind of summarizing and answering the question you provided, what we're interested in then is focusing on versioning the abstract portion of the WSDL typically. That's our first starting point, and then the schema that represents the data and the policy that may be applied as well. And in terms of how we would do that, things that we may version within that would be, for instance, the addition or changes to port types and operations and messages. Those are physical manifestations in the abstract section of the WSDL. An XML scheme would be talking about the addition of elements or attributes or maybe new constraints on the data. And then policy would be talking about potentially addition or changes of what are referred to policy alternatives, as well as optional and ignorable assertions. These are all different ways of describing the governance that you're applying to the service.
Okay. So within each of those, are there different strategies that are used to version, say, the interface, the abstract portion versus the more concrete portion or the data versus the policy? Or is it all basically the same strategy applied to the different schemas?
Yeah, at a high level, the strategies that you apply are more coarse or more business-oriented. You know, you're talking about, am I going to be strict in how I'm going to version? You know, if I make a change in anything, I have to update everything with brand new contracts, you know, a data contract, a policy contract, a service contract, or am I trying to be more flexible and, you know, allow minor changes to occur without impacting my consumers? But in terms of mechanics, in terms of how you actually do the versioning, it is different depending upon what it is that you're focusing on. So examples of this, for instance, would be in WSDL, where we may be you know, adding a new capability, a new operation that somebody's interested in taking advantage of. We may decide that we want to increase the version of that particular contract that we've identified. And within WSDL, typically most people will utilize namespaces for major versions, XML namespaces. And for minor versions, they'll use a combination of maybe attributes or documentation elements within the WSDL itself. Now, if I move to a data contract, a schema, we're talking about, you know, maybe adding elements, changes in constraints. And within schema, they have a attribute that is used typically for versioning. And if it's a major change, then you would change the namespace as well. And when we get into policies, what we're talking about is typically looking at just comments, where we're actually modifying a comment, an XML comment within the policy itself. So the mechanics of what you are changing when you're doing the versioning may be different. And also, there isn't a standard within the XML standard committee, such as W3C or OASIS, that articulates what you're specifically supposed to do. So these are best practices, these are design patterns, and these are design standards that are implemented within an organization. And they may vary within the organization, and they may vary outside of the organization. So these are just common threads that we see with our customers.
Really? So basically, there's no industry-wide way of standardizing. So a client at one company consuming the service at another company, there may be sort of severe, you know, impedance mismatch between versioning strategies.
Absolutely, and that's one of the challenges that, you know, customers can run into. So design standards within service-oriented architecture are very critical in allowing you to first focus on the, you know, the interoperability within the organization. And if you have challenges with that, then sometimes what people do is they'll focus on creating domain inventories or you know, developing versioning within a particular domain and then having to deal with potential transformation across those domains as you share and communicate that within your business or outside of your business. But that is a key component, a key concern when dealing with versioning.
Okay. So one of the I want to make mention of another book in the service-oriented computing series. It's called Web Service Contract Design and Versioning for SOA. In there, they make a distinction between forwards and backwards compatibility. And so these are two ways to handle versioning, right? Yeah, I guess this
Correct.
Is true also for any kind of software design. And again, also very critical in SOA. Can you talk about what these two types of compatibility are?
Sure. Let me kind of, you know, kind of set the groundwork by describing what compatibility is to begin with, and then I can describe, you know, forward and backward compatibility. So the notion of compatibility is that a consumer that is interacting with a contract is able to, you know, share information, get information back without any challenges or problems. And obviously, over time, what happens in most contracts and most services is that new capabilities are added or removed or changes need to be made for whatever reason. And the question then is the consumer that is currently using it still able to take advantage of those capabilities, or you know, do they have to redo the interaction and the effective work behind that particular consumer? So compatibility is just determining, can the consumer interact with a provider effectively? And we have two different approaches that people will look at, and backward compatibility is one of them. And what it does is focuses on the notion of, you know, if I'm going to change my contract, how can I do it so that I maintain compatibility with the existing consumers that are using it? And one way to do that is to focus on, you know, a certain best practice, which would be, you know, I will always add, but I'll never delete, as an example. That's a simple one. So if I add a new capability to a contract, consumers that are using the existing contract, and you know, if they're interested in taking advantage of it, great. If not, they don't need to. It will not impact the consumer that is operating to date because we're adding functionality. We're not eliminating it. We're not renaming it. And thus, in that particular example, we have a simple example of backward compatibility. We're still supporting the existing consumers. Forward compatibility is an approach that what it tries to do is it tries to steer a contract into being very generic or very coarse. And what I mean by that is accepting a wide range of data, and thus you can send, for instance, a string or an integer, and then the next request send a float. And if the contract is set up in such a way, the contract will be able to accept that and process it accordingly, and there's no changes that are required. And what you typically see is that forward compatibility is focusing more on a previous thought that this needs to occur. So from a design perspective, you have to think of it before you actually put out your first contract. And in general, you have to also create a contract that is very generic and very coarse in nature. It typically employs notions of data types like any, as an example, which allows you to pass in a wide range of data. So the backward, again, to kind of summarize, would be I can add, I can put in information that is optional, I can put in information that is alternative, for instance, in policies, and this allows a consumer to pick and choose what they like to use or continue doing what they've always been doing. Forward compatible focuses more on this notion of a very coarse generic description and thus allows a wide range of data, and that's really the responsibility of the service logic to then handle what comes across the wire.
Right, so it sounds like what you end up with backward compatibility is what you would have if you had, let's say, an aging object API, mm-hmm. where you've got a lot of methods that people keep adding so that their previous consumers don't break. But
exactly.
Then you potentially end up with underused or maybe even under-exercised old methods you don't really know much about. And on the flip side, with forward compatibility, what you end up with is an API that's very loosely typed, and then the consuming code basically can take anything.
Exactly.
It also seems to require like a preternatural, prestidigitatory insight into what the future customers are going to need.
And that's one of the challenges with any kind of versioning is, do I know where I'm going? And a lot of times in most businesses, you have no idea. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to identify, when can I use this type of approach or this particular type of capability? And if I have forethought that it's going to need to be generic and process a wide range of data, then forward compatibility is an option for you.
So under what circumstances would you have that kind of knowledge?
What I've seen in the past with customers is when they're dealing with uploads of data, generic data, in the financial sector, for instance, maybe it's batch processing or information that is maybe analytic in nature, and you're firing off maybe non-XML information as an example. This would be a good example of applying a forward compatibility approach where you're sending a request as attachments or you have binary data, maybe images, things of that nature. It's pretty easy to figure out that you're not going to be able to strongly identify the type of input that's going to come in, and thus you need to be able to support a generic type of data. In some situations, for instance, in the intelligence community and others, they have audio, video, could be Excel spreadsheets and others that they have to accept and process. And thus they know that all this type of data coming across the wire and the multiple coding formats that they have to deal with requires that they have a very generic and coarse description. A lot of people prefer the backward compatibility approach, and that's the more applicable of the two, just because of the fact that most customers, when doing so, are trying to define a well-defined and strongly typed contract that matches their business. So you could look at it in the aspect of the types of services that you're developing. If you're developing, utilitarian or technical services, they may be more coarse in nature and more generic in nature, whereas if you are developing business services or entity services, you're focusing more on information that relates directly to a business entity that you deal with and has a very well-defined and static definition, and thus may apply backward compatibility there, whereas forward compatibility more the technical services.
It also kind of depends on where you want your validation to happen too, right? Whether it's
Absolutely.
Going to happen against the schema or whether it's going to happen down in the business layer of the service.
Absolutely. Right. That's another point. Basically, depending upon if you need to execute various lookups and other types of logic that extend beyond the schema validation that you can get, this will provide you an alternative to provide the generic contract and apply it within your core logic, which may be in .NET or Java.
Okay. Well, that all makes sense. So regardless of how you manage to version, whether you're going to go backwards compatible, forwards compatible, you're still going to have some identifiers. Like you said earlier, it could be an attribute, it could be in the namespace, but you still have some attributes to sort of define a given version. How does that affect runtime? Do consumers know at runtime which version they're interacting with? Can they pick and choose? What sort of mechanism is employed there?
Yeah, there are a couple different ways. I mean, from a runtime perspective, especially with WS Policy being available now, people can do queries and basically do a check with the service provider and find out, you know, what version are you providing to me now? And, you know, operations that are provided by the service can then return, you know, the version is this. And thus, once they see that, the consumer then can programmatically then say, okay, I need to send this type of request. Or they may find out, you know what, based on what I'm getting here, it's not matching what I know I can do. And thus, I'm going to have to fault and provide that back to the person that's invoking this. So policy provides one mechanism to kind of flush out or identify that. Another approach is there are standards such as metadata exchange that allow you to query the contract and actually get the contract itself, the WSDL, the schema, the policy, and then programmatically be able to navigate through that to see, again, what is inside of that, what is the namespace, what is the attribute for the minor version, whether it's in the schema or in the WSDL or in the policy, and thus, again, make that determination. So those are some runtime checks that can be applied. And another approach that you could use would be that the provider, on the other hand, rather than the consumer, takes the responsibility, and the provider looks at the request coming in and examines the namespace in the SOAP message, as an example, and says, okay, based on this, I need to send to this version of the service. So some providers will provide side-by-side implementations where they'll have the current version, which may be version 2.0, and then they'll have the previous version. So they may support for 6 months or 12 months the previous version, and that may be 1.1. Both of the services are running in parallel, and using technology like ESB or messaging or in the middleware can examine the requests that come in and then effectively route them based on the SOAP namespace information that's provided, and thus, you know, return the appropriate version back. So those are two examples of one being the consumer owning the situation, figuring out where they need to go and whether they can invoke, or the runtime platform providing and examining the requests and then forwarding them accordingly.
And I suppose, like in a lot of cases, it sort of depends on who got there first.
Exactly.
If you've got a service that's pretty nailed down and not as flexible, and it's a provider, mm-hmm. and you've got a consumer that has to consume two versions, then you build that into the consumer. Otherwise, the provider might be able to handle it.
Right.
So you would talk about using, from a provider standpoint, using an ESB or message-oriented middleware to handle this incoming switching. So that's not something that you would create like a utility service for to do that switching for you.
You could. I mean, there's various approaches in service-oriented architecture to support routing of information. You know, one approach or one pattern that's described that quite often people tie into is the enterprise service bus. So that's a design pattern as well as a product you can purchase that can support that. There are also governance platforms that you can look at that are out in the marketplace today that also provide routing features and kind of overlay. And what they do is they focus on this notion of intermediaries or service agent approach, which is another pattern. And the idea behind that is that you have, you know, code or technology that kind of sits within the cloud or within the infrastructure and the environment, and it is receiving these events, these messages, these requests, and then forward them accordingly using, you know, a content-based routing or other types of technology that are available. So service agents, web of service intermediaries, enterprise service bus, these are all different forms of technology that come and are implemented in different ways, whether they be, you can get them via open source or via a third party that will provide that functionality. You can custom build it or you can purchase it effectively.
So what types of vendors handle ESB? I mean, there seems to be quite a few products out there, right?
Yeah, there's Enterprise Service Bus has been around since like 2003. So you have, you know, small vendors such as, on the governance side, such as AmberPoint that focus on that. Actional, I believe, also supports that. On the larger side, you have Oracle and IBM and Red Hat with their JBoss infrastructure. You have various platforms such as Software AG that kind of blend and mix business process management with enterprise service bus. So there are a variety of platforms that you can purchase, you know, that are out there. And then you can look at the open source space, you know, whether it's Apache or whether it's reference implementations from Sun and others that provide technologies that will provide content-based routing and service agent and or enterprise service bus qualities where you can get that routing and can deal with the side-by-side versioning.
Excellent. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Tune in again next time. We'll be taking a deeper dive into versioning with Chris Riley, co-author of the book SOA Design Patterns, which is available now. For more information on SOA Design Patterns, check out www.soapatterns.org. Chris, thanks so much for talking with us today and sharing your experience.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it, Kevin.
This episode was brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at Inform IT. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or check us out at informit.com/onsoa.